You're tuned to Vibes FM. I am Sarah C, and today's special guest is Reshma B, aka the reggae girl about town, Boomshots journalist, Boomshots presenter, Tidal playlist editor, and column writer, and we can now say accomplished filmmaker and producer. Reshma B has produced a film, The Lost Tapes, from Studio 17, and it's featured on Tidal, it's featured on BBC Radio 4, and it's played on BBC TV. And now, for Black History Month in the UK, it's doing a tour countrywide of the UK. And Reshma has kindly made time to come and talk to us here at Vibes FM. Reshma, welcome to Vibes FM.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. And like I said, you mentioned you've seen the film twice, so that's amazing. And I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed watching it on the big screen.
Well, I saw it first of all on the BBC on a kind of small screen. And then I could not resist when I saw that it had started its tour of the UK to go and see it on the big screen with the big speakers and all the music at full volume. It took it to a whole other level. And congratulations for even making that project come together, because I know it took years.
Thank you. Yes, it did. And, you know, here we are celebrating Jamaica independence, 60 years of Jamaica independence. Shout out to Jamaica. And, you know, I always say this because I've realized when I'm doing these talks that I initially started the story and I did it for BBC Radio 4 for Front Row. And at that time, we did it for the celebration of 50 years of Jamaica independence. So here we are. As you can see, it's been a long journey.
That's right. Well, often these stories are of tenacity, aren't they? So 10 years is definitely a labour of love. How do you even begin to plan a project like this?
Actually, no one's asked me that. I think you don't. I think you don't plan. I think, you know, as a music journalist and a lover of music of all genres, but, you know, I cover a lot of reggae and dancehall. You're covering the genre and the news all the time. And for this particular story, I remember I had written about the tragic death of Joel Chin, Clive Chin's son, which you'll see in the film. It's also part of the film because this film really is a story of one man's quest to salvage his legacy, salvaging these tapes. And it's an honor to his son. So it's a very emotional journey. And you know, it was an emotional topic writing about somebody who's murdered a prominent person on the scene. And I had just covered it for Clash Music. At the time, I was writing a column and a lot of reviews and previews for Clash Music. I'm sure the UK audience is very familiar with that publication. And then during one of my trips to New York, I had bumped into Clive Chin at an event, nothing to do with the story, but just some, you know, I was at an event, he was there, and I wanted to go over, and it was the first time I was seeing him after the tragic moments. I wanted to, you know, pay my respects, give my condolences. And obviously Clive himself is a very accomplished producer. You see in the film how much of a legacy he really has. Sorry, I might have to close right here in Midtown. It's not an ideal time scenario for interviews, but
listen, Midtown meets South London, don't you worry.
So I say all that to say, you know, Clive had invited me down to his office to play to do an interview, to speak with him. And during the interview, he started playing me some music that I hadn't really recognized. I never heard before. And so at first I didn't say anything, and then I was like, oh, what's this, I've not heard it. And he was like, oh, this is some Dennis Brown. And I was like, oh, well, I know Dennis Brown has a pretty extensive catalog, but it's pretty recognizable. I don't recognize. So I pluck up the courage to like, I don't recognize this song. And he was like, oh, you wouldn't, because it's not out, it's never been heard. And I was like, oh, that's weird. And never, you know, I don't know, that's kind of unusual. And then I didn't say anything. We continued the interview. Then he played something else. And I was like, I don't recognize this. He was like, oh, you wouldn't. It's an unreleased Lord Creator. And I was like, okay, I'm not sure what's going on, but like, what do you mean unreleased? This, that can't be possible. These are some greats of reggae. And he was like, well. And then he starts telling me about these lost archives that were found at Studio 17 in North Parade in Jamaica, where, you know, Studio 17 originally was situated. And apparently, you know, during one of his trips to Jamaica, they had found all these tapes. There was basically like 1200 tapes, mix of session tapes, master tapes. So that was pretty amazing. And he was saying that if I hung around in New York, they were going to like announce this to the press. And of course I changed my ticket and was like, of course I have to hang around and, you know, hear what this is all about. So I went to the event, which Pat McKay was hosting, and, you know, I was intrigued. I couldn't believe that there was 1200 tapes of greats of reggae. And some of them, you know, were, you know, of course, a lot of them are people we don't even, are not even here anymore. So it was really intriguing for me. And, you know, I convinced my way into the transfer session tapes, which Clive was doing at the time, because, you know, these tapes are very fragile. You know, they'd been exported very carefully from Jamaica to New York. And now the transfer process was going on where they were reeling off these tapes to digitize them so that they could be in some form of, you know, they could be in a computer, but also not be so fragile. And when I was in there, I realized this was like being in a time capsule, because I wasn't around during some of these greats. I mean, Gregory Isaacs, Dennis Brown, Bob Marley, I wasn't around. And this is music that I love, music I cover. So for me, it was like sitting in a room with them, because the session tapes were the most interesting for me, because it was literally a session. It was a live session. So you could hear talking, you could hear people, you could hear these greats bantering with each other, you know, passing a spliff around perhaps, or, you know, arguing or having a good day or a bad day, but just like bantering and having fun most of the times. And it was amazing just to sit there and listen to them talking with each other. So after that experience, I knew we had to do something. I knew I had to cover the story in some way. So I took it to BBC Radio 4 Front Row, which is their main arts program. And Jamaica Independence 50th anniversary was coming up, and it was the perfect story. And so I was able to do the story for that. And, you know, after the story had come out, I met Mark James of Widescreen Films, and we started developing this into a visual experience. And, you know, cut a long story short, here we are celebrating 60 years of Jamaica independence. So it's been a long journey, as I mentioned, but as the good old Jamaican saying goes, nothing before the time.
Yeah, I've used that so, so much. I'm particularly interested in this Dennis Brown, because it's amazing to think. So if we just put everything into context, and if we just lay out the characters, if you will, for this drama, there's a lot of people will know of VP Records, and a lot of people will know of Greensleeves Records. And VP was kind of the mothership, I guess I call it. And then the subsidiary labels they have are 17 North Parade and the VP and the Greensleeves. And so they named the 17 North Parade after this studio that they had. And these tapes were recorded in the studio.
So 17 North Parade is the address of where Studio 17 exists, and it still exists to this day. And this is where the studio was, this is where the record shop was. And after Jamaica, if you watch the film, you'll see that it starts with the success of Independent Jamaica Song by Lord Creator, which created a lot of success for Vincent Chin, Clive Chin's father. And through that success, and he was able to build a studio upstairs. And with that studio, they were able to have lots of local producers and lots of local artists come in and out, book studio time, make music. And one thing that was very unique about Studio 17 was having the record shop downstairs where Miss Pat would often be and would be able to sell, they could sell this music that they made. So it was kind of like, as Carl Malcolm says in the film, it was like having a package deal, you know. And, you know, remember at the time, there was no local music being played on the radio. So these studios played a really big part of history of Jamaican music, local music, which wasn't being played anywhere. So, you know, there was, it's not just Studio 17, you're talking about Dynamic Studios, Studio One, you know, there's so many studios that played, like a handful of them that were around at that time, where legendary producers were born, legendary singers and musicians, all of these people's craft was born there. And, you know, this music went off to Sound Systems, which, as you know, played in the dance hall, which was a space for people, local people, to come and hear local music. So this is really how local music came along. So it's a really important part of Jamaican music culture that the studios get really recognized. And, you know, you often hear about, you know, musicians and artists who really hung out at certain studios. And I think Studio 17 was an important studio for a lot of musicians because Idler's Rest was not very far away. So a lot of artists got to, you know, hang out together. And then when there was a session, they were very close to a studio. So I think that lots of different things made Studio 17 very important. And you mentioned, so that was the hub, and this was,
do you know, all can I ask a question quickly though about Idler's Rest? And I always wonder this because you say that Idler's Rest was near to the shop, and I wonder if Idler's Rest was there because of the shop or whether it was there before the shop.
Actually, that's something that you might have to do some research on, but I know that from what I understand, it was named that because, yes, artists were hanging out and, you know, it could, and I guess they were hanging out because they wanted to get a session in. So, you
and
know,
it wasn't just any studio, was it? Studio 17. You see, look at me, how clever I am, because I've seen the film twice. And the studios were famous for being really top quality, weren't they? And there's a great part in the film where Lee Perry says it was the best studio to record Bob Marley because there was no whoosh and there was no shh.
And yeah.
That's a great story. But what I wonder more is, in your journey to make this film, how was your interview with Lee Scratch Perry?
Well, you saw it on the big screen. Scratch is an amazing person, RIP. It's so sad to think that he's not here with us anymore. But he is an amazing character, and there's a reason why they called him the Mad Genius, because he had very unique style to his productions. And as you rightfully said, he preferred Studio 17's equipment at the time because it was making a certain sound. And I think that's why people, producers, artists gravitated to their favorite studio, because it was about a sound, just probably not just the sound of the equipment, which I think makes a big difference, but also the vibe and who was the, you know, in-house session musicians at the time. And, you know, at Studio 17, it was Peter Tosh, and then there was Errol Thompson. So there was all these, you know, amazingly talented people that worked there. And so I think Scratch gravitated to that when he did. I mean, he did a lot of stuff at Studio One too. So it's also during, I think it's a time in what people feel they want to do at the time. But I do know from Scratch also mentioned he got upset when they upgraded the studio because he lost the sound that he really loved. Maybe there was a certain type of sound, maybe it got too clean, I don't know, but he did say kind of got annoyed, and then he kind of didn't record there anymore after they upgraded. So, you know, a sound for a producer, I think, is very unique to their ear. Interviewing Scratch is a pleasure. It wasn't the first time I interviewed him. I'd interviewed him before for Boomshots many times. Not many, many times, but I had the privilege at least, I think, two times before. And he's always a great interview. If you can sit there and explain to him, you're doing well, because, you know, he has his own way of doing things and explaining things. So I felt very privileged that he gave the time, explained the things he did, because, you know, there's a lot to learn from someone like Scratch Perry, and his music is still so popular. And there's a reason why he was ahead of his time And I think he's still ahead of people's time now. He's the mad genius for a reason. And that's also why one of my favorite parts in the film is also talking, you know, where the Jobson brothers are talking about how much they were in awe of Scratch Perry. And when they got the chance to work with him, you know, for Mother Country, it was, they were just like, oh my God, we're working with the mad genius, we're working with Lee Scratch Perry. And, you know, in the end, you see, it's a funny scene because they say they didn't have any money, they weren't very good, but, and then Scratch was like, you're Arawak Indians, and he was like, yes, we are, and they would do anything to work with Scratch Perry. And, you know, in the end, they end up paying him in bananas because Scratch was like, oh, you're coming from the country, I want bananas. It's a very funny part of the story, but it just also goes to show, what would you do to work with such a great great producer at the time? And, you know, when I interviewed Scratch, he was in his 80s. So he was one of the only artists of his age still touring at that time. You know, a lot of people in that age are not. So a lot of he's got fans. He's had fans till the end. That's very unique to any musician of any genre.
I've got to say, if we're talking about people that are over 80 as well, salute to Miss Pat, sharp as a razor. And her part of the story is really important too. And I know she was actually Clive's stepmother.
She is Clive's stepmother, yes.
Correct. She is Clive's stepmother. That's right. And her part in the story and playing the songs to the people in the record shop in that same way that you described earlier, that people played the songs on the sound. And then, of course, her move to New York and the setup of VP Records. And what I wanted to also ask you was, you know how in music there's a certain snobbery between, it used to be CDs to vinyl. And then if you go from vinyl to reel, that must have been a magical, because you sat in on those sessions where they actually digitized some of those tapes and heard some of those things for the first time. And I don't want to ruin the film, so everyone's got to go and watch the film to see what comes out of that. But some amazing collaborations come out of that as well. And we're not going to tell them. They've got to go see the film. But I thought that was amazing. And I wondered how that was for you, sitting there listening to those tapes. And you'd said earlier, it was like being back there in the day. But I wonder what's going to happen next. Are there things that will now come out on 17 North Parade or on a different label? What will happen to all those tapes now they've been found?
Well, you know, as you see in the film, you know, Studio 17 is something, and all the archives that are under Studio 17 belonged to Clive Chin. VP Records, it's its own business from what I understand. And, you know, in the film that you see that those two are two different entities. And I believe that Clive owns all the archives now. They were in question at one point during the film. And you see that in the film, of course, also, because, you know, we had to stop filming for 2 years while they two companies had to sort out who about ownership. And, you know, the whole film really is about ownership from top to bottom, because we hear about different parts of ownership with other songs and different artists that we should also talk about. But in terms of the company, VP Records is its own thing, and this is really the story about Studio 17, and it's about the lost reggae tapes of Studio 17, which, yes, Miss Pat Vincent had created back in the 60s, which has changed now in after they came to New York and started a different label. So Clive owns all of these, and hopefully he will, when he feels that it's the right time, will want to put them out, because there's so much great music. And, you know, right now there's an unheard Dennis Brown song, there's a remake of a Lord Creator song. All of these can be heard in the film. And so if you want to hear some of these great songs being remade or re-released, you have to go and watch the film. But I hope he does put them out, because there's a lot of demand for it. And I would like to say that this film was made in a very organic process. You know, it really happened in a natural way. And so I don't think anyone was thinking, oh my God, let's have this business plan of where we're going to have these records out and what are we going to do when the film comes out? I mean, to be honest with you, I had no idea the film was even going to come out because, you know, when you have a 7-year journey in the making of just the film, you don't know. And then there was a lawsuit. It's a tragic film with some tragic moments of, you know, taking Clive back to Jamaica, where after his son had been murdered, was not an easy thing to film. And, you know, I'm so grateful to Clive to have trusted me, to be honest with you. I have not got children. I don't know what it's like to lose a child, but I cannot imagine that's something that you can ever get over. And, you know, having seen Clive go through that, it's a horrible, horrible thing to have to deal with in life. So I'm, you know, all of this came together in a very organic and natural way. And so right now the film is out. If you're a music lover, whether you're into reggae, whether you know everything about reggae, you don't know anything about reggae and you want to know, I think there's something in the film for everybody. There's a human story. There's all the music classics. There's just the history. So I think that's what I'm getting from people's feedback. People love the film. They gravitate to different parts. And also a lot of people who thought they didn't know what a certain song, they just, a lot of times they haven't connected the faces to the names. Like Carl Malcolm, you know, that was a song that hit the British charts, you know, Fatty Boom Boom, Miss Wire Waist. But a lot of people haven't seen what Carl Malcolm looks like. So they get to see these greats, you know, on the big screen.
That's right. And then hear from people that were actually there at the time. And one of the things that comes through is all the anecdotes that Clive has throughout the film, because, of course, it was his life and he lived it. And I hope that perhaps doing some of these things and writing it down and getting the tapes out has in some way helped him put to rest the pain from the passing of his son, because music can be really redemptive.
Well, I think that, I don't know. I would love to think that the film has had some type of therapeutic effect, but I think he's gone through a lot as a person. I think anybody would if they have lost a son. And I think his love for music really comes through. So you really see him, you know, shine and become bright in the film. As you said, he has all these amazing experiences. And what better to hear about these experiences but from someone who was there at the time, you know, on a plane with Peter Tosh, in a studio with Augustus Pablo, with Alton Ellis. You know, who better to tell a story than somebody who's actually there doing it?
And there's some great stories of, I guess, kind of karma almost, that Lord Creator was the first hit that they had from the studio. And then years later, the song was covered by UB40, and the royalties from that paid for Lord Creator's hospital bills and built him a house. So all those things came from music made inside that studio.
Yeah, I mean, you know, props to UB40 for crediting the songwriter, because as you know, at the time that this music, at the time that Kingston Town was being covered by UB40, Lord Creator was, you know, not in a good place, had lost everything, really, was living on the streets, was in hospital at the time, as he said in the film, you know, not doing well. And all of this money started coming in from the royalties. And when I found him, he was living in this huge house off the beaten path in Kingston, in Jamaica, sorry. And he explained that all of this that he had built and all his medical bills and his family, all of this has been paid for by the royalties of Kingston Town that was covered by UB40. So we have to give them some recognition and of doing the right thing, crediting the right people, the right songwriters. And that's something that happens not just in reggae. You've had horror stories all across the genres of music where people, ownership is up for question all the time. The wrong people are credited, different people are collecting money on different people's names. It's something that is rife in the music industry, whichever genre it is. But in you hear a lot of things like this in the reggae industry, and you know, not everybody is or has been as fortunate as Lord Creator. So it's a really happy story in the end. I had got, when I was interviewing him, he had actually already have had two strokes. So, you know, the fact that he's got enough money from the royalties to take care of his medical bills is a big thing. So I just would like to enhance, like, look what happens when you do the right thing. You can save somebody's life and their livelihood. And, you know, when a lot of artists are not getting credited for their art, for their craft, and a lot of people are, I mean, you see the Jimmy Cliff clip in Studio 17 film where The Harder They Come, and you see the part where he's in the studio and he's like, what's this? This is no amount of money. And that's what it was. You know, a lot of artists were being paid nothing for sessions that other producers and maybe and other people were benefiting from. So, you know, yes, like you said, there is a karma element to it, which, you know, this the film does talk about the economics. It touches on the economics of reggae, and I think a lot of people now can still relate to those things. There's a lot of, you know, cases that come up every day that I hear about in music genres, where people are fighting for the rights of their own craft.
Exactly. And there's so many stories in the film about Clive Chin going to school with Augustus Pablo, and we don't have time for any more of those. So if anybody wants to hear the stories, they need to go check out the film, which brings me neatly to where you can find it. Kush Cinemas are actually doing a tour of the UK with this film. And literally from Belfast to Cornwall. And I know it's going to be at the Ritzy on the 13th of October. So if anybody wants to check out where they can go see it, it's kushcinema.com/events/studio-17. And that just leaves me to say, thank you, Reshma, for coming to talk to us about the film. We really do appreciate it. And what's next for you? Will there be more films?
Yes, of course, hopefully. But, you know, I'm going to stick to the old Jamaican saying, nothing before the time. I do want to shout out everybody who's taken the time to watch the film. It's been an amazing journey. And, you know, I've just come off this incredible global tour of the film. We were in Rotterdam, Spain, and we were just in Trinidad. We did an extensive tour of Canada. And now, as you say, we've been in Brazil, Poland. We're going to be in Belgium and Barcelona. And I just want to shout out the BBC, Iambic Dreams, and Widestream Films, because it's taken all of these people to come together to make this film. And also want to say, please check out the Linktree. It's Studio 17 Movie is the Linktree. Studio 17 Movie is the Twitter. Studio 17 Movie is the Instagram and the Facebook. Of course, the film Studio 17, The Lost Reggae Tapes. I hope you enjoy it. Shout out to Kush Films for putting this on for the UK massive. Shout out to everyone in the UK who's enjoying the film, who may go and watch it more than once, who may go and watch it twice. Tell a friend. Tell a friend to tell a friend if you love it.
Thank you so much, Reshma B. You can also catch her monthly column, Murder, She Wrote, on Tidal.
Yes, you can. And this month's out already with a Skang and Nicki Minaj collab. So it's all about the latest dance hall.
Brilliant. Thank you.